This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, after Israel's 51 days of attacks on homes, hospitals, schools, and infrastructure, we speak with Dr. Mona Elfara, physician and human rights advocate, about the wide spectrum of trauma inflicted on Gaza's children.
We will be faced with increasing number of children that will need serious intervention. It will be subject to trauma of losing your home or losing family member of the family or friend or neighbor. And we need to work hard to try to release the effect of the trauma on those children.
Also, as Palestinians mark 1 year of return to their destroyed village of Kfar Biram, Israeli authorities cut water, electricity, and gas, and loot and confiscate Palestinians' camping supplies. Patrick O. Strickland reports from the village. And Yafa Jarar, daughter of Palestinian legislator Khalida Jarar, speaks about her mother's so-called internal deportation order, meted out by Israel, an order she has refused to follow. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland, with Patrick O. Strickland in Palestine. During the 51 days of Israel's attacks on Gaza, which ended in a ceasefire agreement on August 26th, a total of 2,168 people were killed, 521 of them children, according to Al Mizan Center for Human Rights. The United Nations estimates that 108,000 people have no homes to return to and will need permanent rehousing. Of the more than 3,000 children wounded, the UN estimates that 1,000 of them will suffer a permanent disability as a result of their injury. Meanwhile, the UN adds, thousands of unexploded bombs and shells pose a danger to civilians returning to areas they fled from during the fighting, putting children at particular risk. The UN says that at least 216 schools in Gaza, including 141 government schools, 75 UN schools, and 4 private or kindergarten schools, were partially damaged due to Israeli airstrikes or shelling. At least 25 schools were reportedly severely damaged to the extent that they can no longer be used. The school year was supposed to start on August 24th, but has been indefinitely suspended for the 500,000 Palestinian school children because of the serious damage to school buildings, or the thousands of Palestinians remaining in UN school shelters as they have no homes to go back to. The Institute for Middle East Understanding released a comprehensive fact sheet on the impact Israel's onslaught has had and will continue to have on Gaza's youth. The IMEU says that by UN estimates, 373,000 children require direct and specialized psychosocial support, while all of Gaza's approximately 900,000 children have been affected by the war and need some level of psychosocial support. The IMEU says that at least one Palestinian minor, a 17-year-old boy named Ahmed Abu Raida, was held hostage for 5 days by invading Israeli soldiers and used as a human shield during their search for tunnels near his home near Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, according to an investigation carried out by Defense for Children International Palestine. Most children aged 6 and older in Gaza have lived through 3 major Israeli military assaults during their short lifetimes, the first in the winter of 2008 to 2009 and the second in November 2012. Joining us to talk about the current situation was Dr. Mona Elfara, a physician in Gaza City who works with the Palestine Red Crescent Society and is the director of Gaza Projects with the Middle East Children's Alliance. She spoke to us from her home in Gaza City on Thursday. I asked her to begin by describing what her neighborhood looks like after the 51 days of Israeli attacks.
Yeah, it's a great deal of destruction. Not far away from my place, just 100 meters, there's a big mosque that has been destroyed completely. And for another further 200 meters, I could see a big tower block that has been leveled to the ground, toppled to the ground, with 50 housing units. And this is like just big heap of rubble. Shattered windows still in the street. People couldn't have time to fix their windows because this is my building, actually. It's my building, and of course, many buildings in Gaza. I move 100 meters, 200 meters, then between every few blocks, you find blocks that have been destroyed, block of buildings, I mean. The situation is very sad. Sad because not only because of the destruction of the building, because people, I see people in the streets, especially youth, young kids, like youth who are usually laughing, giggling. Everybody is like as if they're big, huge trauma on the faces of everybody. The people don't smile easily, and you can see the size of the effect of the 51 days, especially on the faces of the kids, the teenagers. They are just walking with lack of energy, lack of enthusiasm. And of course, let alone the children, because the children, according to statistics, maybe 99% of us are traumatized, one level or another. I'll talk about myself, but first, children. One in two children have been subjected to real trauma. Back to myself, the first day, after the attack stopped, I was in a state of shock, quiet. Then second day, I started to burst into tears, white, loudly. Whenever I say hello to anybody or see people at my work, white, loudly. And sometimes I was hysterical, laughing loudly. Laughing, but without the good feeling of the laugh. It is the artificial laugh. It is hysterical laugh. I stayed like that for the first 5 days, but now I am back to, I'm slowly getting my balance back, but without really feeling of life. I feel that I have to do things, but I don't enjoy doing things. For example, I tried several times to watch TV, then I feel that I can't watch any soap or any film. I can't. No matter I force myself, then I switched off the TV. Actually, we don't have enough electricity. But usually, when we don't, even before the attack, with the very dire situation, before the attack, the siege and the problem of the water and electricity, etc., we used to find ways of coping with the situation. One way of coping for me was walking. Another way was listening to music or watching some TV when I have electricity. Now, I don't find the comfort in walking. I don't find comfort in watching TV or listening to music. I don't listen to music now. It is not because of I'm sick of mourning. No, it is because I don't simply enjoy the music or the nice lyrics I used to like for Arabic singers. So this is not natural. Maybe next month I'll be back to my normal, but I don't think so, because the size of the catastrophe is great. I am surrounded with destruction, either in my neighborhood or in my way to work, or I see it on the faces of the children and the teenagers, let alone the mothers of the displaced families who are trying hard to go on with their lives, or the people who lost their homes, or the people who lost their loved ones, or the injured children, the injured adults. 2,000 of the injured are children, 465, I'm not sure the numbers, but it is nearly 465 are children. And I don't see it like that. Children have died. It is not just numbers, Nora. It is the story beyond this loss. It's the story beyond those kids who have been injured, and many of them lost one arm or one leg because of the severity of the attacks. It needs a lot of analysis. It is not just getting safety or security for Israeli citizens. It is not at all, like that at all, because after all, the resistance here are resistance. It's not an army. And they are facing one of the strongest armies in the world. So I cannot absorb or understand or get on with what happened to us during the 51 days. It was beyond words. It was not war crimes. There was a systematic way of genocide. They were trying to get rid of us all. And if the ceasefire, I'm glad, I'm relieved that the ceasefire started, because if it did not start, we would have been a little destruction more than what we are seeing in Gaza. So I'm relieved it happened. In the last 3 days before the ceasefire, and this is my personal story, my own story, I wrote in the Facebook few days later, now we are watching stories of people, and I'm afraid that I will be one of the stories one day. It happened with me when my relatives were killed, and you covered that, I think, Nora. But later on, the last 3 or 4 days, when they started attacking the block towers and big buildings, and I live on one of those buildings, they started warning next building to my building and another building. It's not building, it is like 14 stories of very, very big buildings. So I feel that I am on the road. My building is on the road. And I had a deep feeling of sad. First, I surrendered. I couldn't go to my flat because I was living in another place, on and off. So I felt deep feeling of sadness and surrender that it's going to happen to me. I'm going to leave my home. The next day, and it was dangerous, my area. I couldn't reach my home to collect things or to do anything. It was undershelling and very dangerous. So the morning, very early, not very early, around 9 o'clock, I have decided to go to my, when the shelling stopped, I have decided to go to my flat. Have you been to my flat, Nora?
Yes, I remember I stayed there for about a week in 2008.
It just opened the seaside, yes. Then I went to my flat and with determination to fill two suitcases with some of my children's photos, my late mother and late father and brother photos, and just very few items to keep me going if the whole house had been demolished. And it was not easy for me to fill this two suitcases of my belongings, because while I'm doing this, and I slammed the door, I was in tears and I said bye-bye. Then a few hours later, ceasefire started, so I was very much relieved that it did not happen to me, and I survived the attack. And that's just in summary.
That's the voice of Dr. Mona El-Farah speaking to us from Gaza City. Dr. Mona, can you talk a little bit more about what children have been telling you? You work with children and women. In terms of those who have no homes to go back to or have lost family members or who will be dealing with psychological trauma or physical disabilities, what will their life be like? As you said, even though the bombs have stopped falling, that's obviously not the end of the story here in Gaza.
No, it's not the end of the story, because we will be faced with increasing number of children, as I have mentioned earlier on, that we need serious intervention because they are subject to trauma of losing their home or losing family member of the family or friend or neighbor. And we need to work hard. We work hard to try to alleviate the effect of the trauma on those children. NACA started, maybe East Children's Alliance started this project, which we called it Let Them Play and Heal. We started it after the first attack, the first war. I don't call it war, I call it assault. But anyway, a few years ago we started this project and it proved to be very helpful for children, and our team discovered many cases that need to be referred to mental health centers. The project was a mixture between entertaining and professional way of dealing with traumatized children. And we are going to start this again soon. So I appeal to everybody to help NACA to start helping the Palestinian children who were subjected to trauma during the latest attack against Gaza. Actually, not only those who are subjected to direct trauma, because there is indirect trauma, which is the whole children of Gaza Strip has been subjected to the darkness, the sound of the shelling, listening to the rubble on top of their homes. Maybe it did not hear them directly, physically, I mean, but living in such atmosphere for continuous 51 days, sure, it affected most of the children of Gaza Strip. There are two parts of the children. Direct effect, those who lost their homes and family, and those who were indirectly affected because of the sounds and feeling of insecurity, being terrified most of the times because of the sounds of the airplanes and the sounds of the shelling, which affected adults as well. It affected all of us. But when it comes to children, it is even harder.
Again, that's Dr. Mona El-Fadda. She's a physician, works with the Palestine Red Crescent Society, and also is the director of Gaza Projects with the Middle East Children's Alliance. And for more information on Dr. Mona's work and the work of NACA, you can go to meccaforpeace.org. Dr. Mona El-Fadda, we're so glad that you're safe and that you're back home in Gaza City. Thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Okay, thank you, Nora.
For 1 week beginning on August 4th, Palestinians living in present-day Israel gathered in the destroyed village of Kfar Biram for a celebration of return, engaging in art, music, lectures, and tours that teach the village's Palestinian history. More than 70 youth attended. For more than a year, Palestinians have camped inside Kfar Biram, acting upon their guaranteed right of return to their ancestral village. Just weeks later, Israeli police showed up and looted the village, confiscating camping equipment and shutting off water, gas, and electricity. Patrick O'Strickland reports from the village.
That's 12-year-old Yusuf singing Ali al-Kufiya, a popular song by acclaimed Palestinian musician Mohammed Assaf. And this is how the last night of a week-long youth camp kicked off in the destroyed Palestinian village of Kfar Biram. A night of traditional songs, dance, and laughter was in order. After all, the more than 70 kids present had spent a week maintaining homes, learning about Palestinian history, and doing other artistic activities. The camp is designed to build awareness of their ancestral connections to Kfar Biram and its tragic history. The village was one of hundreds like it that were depopulated during the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine that led to Israel's establishment. Unlike most of those villages, the refugees from Kfar Biram were promised they'd be allowed to return when the fighting ended. But years passed and it became clear that Israel's occupation military was not going to make good on its promises. Despite a court order ruling that refugees could return to their homes in Kfar Biram, the Israeli Air Force showered the village with bombs in 1953. Homes, schools, and businesses were all destroyed. Only a historical church and a graveyard were left intact. Most of the refugees became internally displaced persons scattered across the Palestinian communities in what became Israel. Today, the surviving refugees and their ancestors are part of the estimated 1.7 million Palestinians who carry Israeli citizenship. According to Adale, a Haifa-based legal center, they face dozens of racist laws that limit their access to state resources and stifle their political expression. For decades, these refugees and their families tried to reach an agreement with the Israeli government, but their nominal citizenship and previous court rulings in their favor did little to further their case. It was clear that Israel was not interested in allowing them to return to their lands. But things changed in August 2013 when a group of activists with ancestral ties to Kfir Biram decided to take matters into their own hands. Understanding that Israeli courts rarely, if ever, deliver justice to Palestinians, they set up camp in Kfir Biram and refused to leave. The Electronic Intifada met with some of these activists during the 25th annual youth camp of return. This year is special, they explained, because it also marks the one-year anniversary of their return to Kfir Biram. George Gantous is an organizer and member of Al-Awde, the group that organized the return to Kfir Biram. He is also one of the supervisors at this year's youth camp. He spoke to the Electronic Intifada about the harassment that activists face from Israeli authorities. Gantous said, "Sometimes we build things and they come and they destroy it, and then they don't want to make a big deal out of it, so they go away. Our bathroom there was also destroyed. This part here," he said, pointing to a wall, "we built a wall to make it safe for the children. They came and tore it down. We've been playing this game for more than 30 years with summer work camps and summer camps, but we started even before with many ways to reclaim our lost land." Gantous also explained that the Al-Awde activist movement is based on a progressive and left-wing ideology. But the focus of the youth camp is on teaching the kids how Kfir Biram is part of the broader Palestinian cause. Gantous said, quote, "The children absorb it very easy because I think they enjoy it. At the same time, they have very good activities and strong relations. They get to know each other. They are living in different places, different cities, different villages around Haifa, Akka, Makkah, Jaish, Nazareth, and Jerusalem." George's cousin, Waad, is a 23-year-old activist who lives in Haifa. Also a member of Al-Awde, she is one of the counselors at this year's youth camp as well. She explained her family's history in Kfir Biram as she stood in front of the partially standing remains of her grandfather's home.
Yeah, so this is my grandfather's house, the one next to it. This is my father's uncle's house. He got killed actually in 48 near his house because he came back to the house. They lived in the mountains around Biram in 48, waiting to come back. Then after like 2 weeks, they tried to come back to the village again. Then they told them like the war is not over, so you need to leave the village again. And they kept trying. They kept trying to come back to the village. And then they just had enough of this and went to Al-Jesh. It's a village near Biram.
Although Waad used to visit Kfir Biram several times a year while growing up, she says she now comes several times a month. Since the August 2013 return to the village, she has joined the group of activists who sleeps in shifts in order to keep watch. On the last night of the camp, participants performed plays and sang songs. Three campers wrote a song about Kfir Biram's youth returning to the village and rebuilding it. The camp ended on a positive note, yet on August 11th, just days later, Israeli occupation authorities arrived in the village and hassled a group of activists on site. Officers took photographs of their ID cards and warned them to cut off the electricity, water, and gas. And yet another 2 weeks later, Israeli land authorities showed up again. Accompanied by police, they arrived in Kfir Biram around 8 a.m. on Wednesday, August 27th. For more than an hour, they looted the village and confiscated camping supplies. They loaded mattresses, camping tents, lights, and other items into a large container and hauled it off. They also cut the water, gas, and electricity to the campsite. Despite this incessant harassment from Israeli occupation authorities, activists say they're going to remain in Kfar Biram for as long as they can. Reporting for the Electronic Intifada, this is Patrick O. Strickland in Kfar Biram.
The Electronic Intifada reported this week that Palestinian Legislative Council member Khalida Jarar is resisting an Israeli occupation order to banish her from her home in Ramallah and the occupied West Bank to the district of Jericho for 6 months. Jarar has set up a protest camp at the Palestinian Legislative Council, the Palestinian Authority legislature, in Ramallah, where she will remain until the order is lifted. Quote, "It is the occupation who must leave our homeland," she has said. Jarar refused to sign the military order, quote, "to put her under special monitoring," that was handed to her by an Israeli occupation officer at her home in the early hours of August 20th. She is a senior member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and a board member of Admir Prisoner Support. Forced transfers are prohibited under international law. In a recent interview with Palestine's Watan TV, Khalida Jarar said that the army, quote, "stormed our house. They came with many soldiers, including women soldiers and an intelligence officer. He identified himself as such and told me that there is an order to deport me to Jericho." Jarar added that the army claimed that they have so-called intelligence information that she, quote, "poses a threat to the security of the region and must deport herself to Jericho within 24 hours. Jarar refused to sign the order and told them, quote, "You are an occupation that is killing my Palestinian people. You practice mass arrests, you demolish homes, you kidnap people from their homes, and you deport them. You must leave our house. I refused to sign the order as a matter of principle." The National Lawyers Guild Palestine Subcommittee released a statement on August 27th in defense of Khalida Jarar, saying, quote, "Even before it began its assault on Gaza, Israel began a massive crackdown on Palestinian political activists throughout the West Bank, arresting hundreds, raiding offices, and severely restricting civilian movement." In the week that Khalida Jarar was ordered to deport herself, the Israeli army made 53 incursions into West Bank communities and arrested 90 Palestinians, including 48 from Jerusalem. There is little doubt Jarar's expulsion is an integral part of Israel's wider political crackdown. Specifically, the order is based on Israel's accusation that Jarar poses a threat to the general security of the area. But like other military orders that Israel issues to Palestinians throughout the occupied territories, Jarar's order does not specify or explain much of anything, including why Israel considers her to be, quote, "dangerous." Nevertheless, there is likely a connection between Israel's desire to banish Jarar from Ramallah and her vocal criticism of the Palestinian Authority's security coordination with Israel. Jarar's expulsion from Ramallah clearly violates Article 42 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. As an occupying power, Israel cannot intern or otherwise forcibly relocate any Palestinian living under occupation, absent a showing of absolute necessity. Israel has made no such showing with regards to Jarar. Further, the order likely violates Article 49, which prohibits Israel from banning a Palestinian living in the West Bank from the territory. That was from a statement by the National Lawyers Guild Palestine Subcommittee. A few weeks ago, Khalida Jarar's daughter, Yaffa, was interviewed at the People's Social Forum in Ottawa, Canada, about her mother's internal deportation order and the links between Indigenous struggles in the U.S. and Canada on the land also called Turtle Island and in Palestine. Independent radio station CKUT featured this interview with Yaffa at the People's Social Forum in late August.
So I'm here at the People's Social Forum in Ottawa with Yaffa Jarar, who is a Palestinian Palestine solidarity activist. We're going to be speaking about a number of different issues. But first, Yaffa, I guess an issue that touches really close to home is something that's happened to your mother lately, Khalida Jarar, who is a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council, also a longtime activist with the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. She was just ordered an internal expulsion order by Israeli occupation forces on Tuesday. That sounds like a bit of a Kafkaesque thing thing, an internal expulsion order. But maybe can you tell us what exactly that is and tell us what's happening with your mother, Khalida Jarrah, right now?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yes, as you mentioned, my mother, I mean, about 50 Israeli soldiers raided our house on Tuesday.
In Ramallah?
In Ramallah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's in the West Bank, in area so-called A, which is technically or supposedly an area A under the Oslo Agreement, must be under the Palestinian Authority control. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, with the so-called security collaboration and cooperation between the Palestinian Authority and Israeli forces, the Israeli forces invade and raid very freely. And in this very example, they handed my mother a military court order to be deported from the city where she lives, which is Ramallah, to another Area A city, which is Jericho. This is something that hasn't happened since the 80s. It's quite unique, and all we can say and how she sees it, how we see it, is that this is just a form of punishment. It's just one way of Israeli authorities and the Israeli apartheid state practicing some of their apartheid policy continuously with impunity. Mm-hmm. So this is just one form of it. We're also very puzzled by this. On one hand, my mother is an activist like most Palestinians. We live under occupation. We live under an apartheid regime. On the other, she's an elected member of parliament. Mm-hmm. And in her case, so far, the Palestinian Authority has not in any way said anything about this decision or court order. Now, just in terms of quick updates, my mother refused to comply with the order. She remains in Ramallah. She moved from, they gave her a 24-hour period to remove herself from the city of Ramallah to the city of Jericho, and they handed her a map of the limits of the city of Jericho where she's not allowed to leave. She announced that she refuses to comply with this arbitrary order, and then she emphasized that we are people under continuous occupation. These kinds of acts are only some of the outrageous acts that are committed by the Israeli apartheid state, such as murdering people, such as continuing the siege on Gaza, bombing civilians, arresting people, expelling and deporting, theft of land, etc. So she just moved now to a protest tent. She's tenting at the Legislative Council until the decision is revoked.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't actually a unique measure that the Israeli occupation forces have done. There have been other examples of, I guess, almost like deporting Palestinians from their own land, which is already occupied. Can you maybe like tell us a little bit more about this wider practice of internal expulsion?
In terms of internal expulsion, as I mentioned, in terms of Israeli military court order, it hasn't been issued since the 1980s. Now, in terms of systematic deportation and expulsion of Palestinian people, it's been happening continuously since 1948. Mm. And this takes place in many different shapes and forms. Some Palestinians who are now refugees are have been expelled from their homes in 48. Areas to the West Bank. Some have been expelled outside of Palestine to refugee camps in Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, etc. And others are in exile elsewhere, all over the world. But to issue, and again, this is why I'm mentioning this situation is kind of unique, and there is nothing, you know, it's not news that Israel would commit a such a thing or issue such a decision that doesn't make sense. Of course, this particular decision violates Article 49 of the Geneva Convention, mm-hmm. That basically states protecting civilians under a situation of war or occupation, mm-hmm. in which case they have violated not just this article, but so many international laws.
It also mentions, because you brought up the Geneva Convention, mm-hmm. The Geneva Convention prohibits there's a condition around prohibiting assigned residence or something like that. Maybe I got that wrong, but specifically around this, how does the Geneva Convention relate to that?
Right. Well, one of the main things that they're in violation of is transferring civilians from one area to another in occupied territories. This is a clear violation of international law and particularly Geneva Convention. So by doing so, Israel, and again, I just want to go back to the point before of why this is a unique situation, is because, as we know, after the signing of the Oslo Agreement, which we still suffer from today, supposedly they created areas of different control for the Palestinian Authority. Some are shared, some under Israeli military control. And in this case, they are removing a person from one area that is supposedly under Palestinian Authority control to another area that is supposedly under Palestinian Authority control. Mm. So we don't see this. We don't see anything in this except for it's a form of humiliation and punishment. And if she doesn't comply, she's under the threat of being arrested by Israeli authorities. Meanwhile, it also shows the failure of our own Palestinian Authority and so-called leadership in protecting their own people and the Palestinians, let alone their elected legislators. It's just a complete shame. It's humiliating, it's embarrassing, and again, it's just one form of Israel practicing its continuous oppression and apartheid policies with impunity.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn the attention to Ottawa and the unceded Algonquin territory that we're on right now. We've been focusing a lot on anti-colonial issues throughout the People's Social Forum, and I'm wondering maybe, you know, what are some of, like, I guess the overarching currents and similarities and ties that you can see between the indigenous struggle in Palestine and indigenous struggles here on Turtle Island.
Yes, of course. And we always have to recognize, and for me as a settler on this land, we always have to recognize in our work and organizing, but also in our learning and mind and teaching and all of it, consciousness that we cannot, and I'm speaking now as a Palestinian and as a Palestine solidarity activist, we cannot meaningfully talk about the liberation of Palestine in this context here on unceded Algonquin territory or any other territory. We cannot talk about the liberation of the Palestinians and Palestine meaningfully without being in solidarity with the indigenous people everywhere. And in this case, particularly the people that we, you know, the people of this land and of this territory. And this would include being in solidarity, includes being a part of their campaigns, being in continuous communication with them, because this is what makes us stronger. One of the things that unites us is that as Palestinians and as indigenous people, here in Turtle Island, is that we're both subject to colonial projects. Now, colonial projects differ, but they have a lot of striking similarities that we see. History repeats itself, greed repeats itself, and manifests itself in many different ways. And we see a lot of similarities in terms of the actual apartheid policies that exist, let's say, in Palestine by the Israeli apartheid regime and the policies that the indigenous people have been subject to here in Turtle Island and in particularly here in Canada. Residential schools, different forms of projects that led slowly to what is called or used as ethnic cleansing of certain people, separation. Legal separation. We see it here with the reserve system. Residential schools, people still suffer from it until today. And same in Palestine. We see these kind of legal separations and slow genocide and ethnic cleansing. In many ways it's slow, but we have been seeing it happening quicker with the situation in Gaza recently. So again, the one thing that I have learned growing up in Palestine as an indigenous Palestinian person who lived under apartheid, under occupation, under colonization, and now I am a settler on this colonized land, is that I have always learned, not only from the teaching of my parents, but also my own experience, that we must always be in solidarity, in meaningful communication with all oppressed peoples around the world, all colonized people around the world, because there will be no liberation of one people as long as there is other people who are still colonized and not liberated. Mm.
That was Yaffa Jarar, a Palestine solidarity activist and organizer based in Ottawa, Canada, speaking to CKUT Radio from the recent People's Social Forum. Thanks to CKUT for that audio. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of writers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.